Celebrating the written word, this is The County Writes, The County Reads, with Lynn Pickering on 99.3 County FM.
Welcome to the show. Marilyn Simons is the author of 20 books in a variety of genres, ranging from personal essay, memoir, travel, literary fiction, and creative nonfiction. Today, she returns to The County Writes, The County Reads with her latest work, Woman Watching, Louise de Caroline Lawrence and the Songbirds of Timisi Bay. This one is a combination of memoir and biography. I'll speak to Marilyn in just a moment, but first, here's a clip from a video based on the book and narrated by Marilyn.
Every morning for 50 years, Louise de Caroline Lawrence walked the paths through her forest on the Mattawa River, watching the songbirds that arrived from their winter homes in Central and South America to breed in Northern Ontario. Louise was born in 1894, goddaughter of the Queen of Denmark and a debutante at the Swedish court. She was close to her father, a devoted conservationist, and she expected to inherit the family estate on the Baltic Sea. But when her father died suddenly, the land was sold for debts, and Louise was forced to move with her mother and her sister to a small apartment in Stockholm. Headstrong and principled, Louise trained as a Red Cross nurse as soon as the First World War erupted. She was posted to a Russian prisoner of war camp, where she fell in love with a white Russian officer, Gleb Nikolaevich. They married, and she followed him to Archangel, high in the Russian Arctic. When the white Russians were defeated by the Bolsheviks, Louise and Gleb joined 1,000 sleigh loads of refugees in a futile dash to Finland. They were captured and sent to a Moscow prison, where Gleb vanished.
I simply couldn't believe that I wouldn't see him again. So I stayed on in Russia for 3 more years after, always hoping that I would be able to find out what had happened.
Louise and Gleb had dreamed of emigrating to Canada, a country much like Sweden and Russia. In 1926, she emigrated alone, landing in the village of Bondfield, east of North Bay, Ontario, where she set up a Red Cross outpost hospital. Traveling to the sick by dog sled in winter and Model T Ford in summer. Among her patients were the Dions, who became famous as parents of the first quintuplets in the world to survive more than a day. As nurse in charge, Louise brought the babies through their first year, but the media circus around the quints was overwhelming. She bought a piece of forest on Pimisi Bay, had a log cabin built, and retreated into her wilderness. Today, the Trans-Canada Highway roars past Louise's forest, but when she bought the property, that road was just a survey line through the trees. She hired a local man, Len Lawrence, to finish the inside of the cabin and build her furniture. He stayed on, building a cabin of his own deeper in the woods, the foundation stones still visible today. Together, they started a poultry business with the hope that chickens and eggs would pay the bills while Louise wrote a book about her year with the quints. Len and Louise grew close, and on September the 11th, 1939, the day after the Second World War was declared, they eloped. And Louise waved her second husband off to war.
When Len was overseas, my days were occupied from the early morning until late at night. And all was governed by my study of birds.
Slowly, with the help of books, Louise learned to tell a hairy woodpecker from a pileated, a white-crowned from a white-throated sparrow. She corresponded with expert bird scientists across North America and Europe, especially women like herself, who were juggling domesticity and science. women who helped change ornithology from a science that killed its subjects in order to analyze them to an observational study of how birds behaved.
That was a clip from a video based on Marilyn Simon's book, Woman Watching, Louise de Caroline Lawrence and the Songbirds of Panisi Bay. Welcome back to the County Rights, the County Reads, Marilyn.
I'm very happy to be here.
Louise died 30 years ago, and you write that she has been on your mind since then. When and how did you come to know Louise?
Well, I didn't live that far from her. So at that time in my life, I was living in Northern Ontario, just south of North Bay. And she was on Pimisi Bay, which is near Bonfield. So as the crow flies, we were, I don't know, maybe 7-10 kilometers apart. And I met her first at the launch of her last book called To Whom the Wilderness Speaks. And I had bought a copy of her book. I had read most of her books by then. And I went to her book signing in North Bay to get the book signed. And I went late thinking, well, if I go late, people will have dissipated and I could spend some time with her. But no, there were still at least 100 people at the book signing. And we you know, had a very brief exchange while she signed my book. And then we met a couple of times after that. Well, more than a couple. We went back and forth a little bit. She was 86, I think, when I met her, and I was about 30. And the last time I saw her, she was 95, 96. Yeah. So over a 10-year period, we knew each other and saw each other from time to time and talked. And then I moved away and I pitched a story on her to Harrow Smith magazine, and they were quite excited about it. So I went back to North Bay and interviewed her for that profile. And at that time, she had already left her log house nest and was living in a nursing home. And so I took her back to her log cabin, and we had an afternoon together. I put together a Swedish smorgasbord, and we had a really nice time. And she loved the profile, and you know, she didn't ever really lose her sharpness, her brain, even though she was 98 when she died. And so she asked me to be her biographer, and you know, I sort of said, oh sure. I was young, and I had really no idea what that meant. And I don't read biographies, and there's something about biographies that I often find disconcerting in traditional biographies, where the writer becomes this omniscient narrator of someone else's life. And I couldn't at the time figure out how not to do that.
Yeah.
'Cause I didn't want to do that, right? I wanted Louise to speak for herself. And so it took me quite a long time to, not that she was on my mind all the time, but I was certainly thinking about it from time to time, because I felt the responsibility to her. I admired her a lot. And finally, when I started going back and forth to Mexico, that was kind of my entree. I started thinking more about birds, because we saw the birds in their wintering grounds there, the same birds that we see certainly up around North Bay in their breeding grounds. And that notion of migration kind of stuck with me, and how I was now migrating 6 months of the year in each part of the country. And she was born in Sweden, and she migrated to Canada, but never stopped being Swedish, and became sort of uber Canadian, as many immigrant people do, the same way as I'm sort of uber Mexican when I'm there. So it was getting back to the birds and getting this sense of migration that I began to see how I could write her story and let her tell her part of the story through her own writings, etc., and yet sort of bear the bones of biography, as it were, talk about the biographical process and my discomfort with some of it, and the kinds of things that I was doing to get to know her. So it the whole process became evident in the book.
Before we talk a little bit about her life as a naturalist and ornithologist, I wanted to talk about her caring for the Dionne quintuplets and the book she wrote, The Quintuplets' First Year, The Survival of the Famous Five Dionne Babies and Its Significance for All Mothers. And it seems that she carefully observed each infant as an individual, made meticulous notes, and came to conclusions on how to raise healthy children, which was sunshine, fresh air, cleanliness, close attention, and affection. And it occurred to me that that was how she came to observe birds, each as an individual, and again, meticulous in her record keeping.
Yes, and that's, she didn't see it that way. She saw the quince, as she called it, an intermezzo, a time out of her life that had nothing to do with her life, really. She was born in 1894 and grew up out in the countryside. She was born into an aristocratic family, grew up on a huge family estate. Her father was a great conservationist. He and his friends started the world's second conservation area just in the Baltic Sea. And so she had this conservationist beginning. And then she became a nurse and, you know, was in Russia and did the quince. And then she went back to nature. So that's how she saw it. But I saw it in the way that you describe and I describe in the book, which is, I think it was all of a piece. She was an observer by nature.
Yeah.
And she was, one of the things she was really good at was absenting herself from the picture and focusing entirely on what she was observing. And so she learned to observe, you know, quite literally on her father's knee. And when she was nurse to the quince, she gave herself wholeheartedly to them. And, you know, she wheeled their carriages out into the, you know, they had their hour a day in the fresh air, even when it was minus 30 out. And it was a miracle at the time in 1934 that these babies survived. They were the first babies to survive more than one day. And after a year, their chances of a healthy, well, at least physically healthy adulthood was the same as any other Canadian child. And the other thing she was good at is extrapolating from that individual observation to its meaning, its larger cultural or environmental meaning. And in that book, she talks about the infant mortality rate in Canada at the time and how that could be changed. There's a wonderful review in the Winnipeg Tribune, I think it was, a very ironic statement that, oh my goodness, this is the most revolutionary book ever written. This woman is actually suggesting that we treat babies as well as we treat soldiers.
Yeah.
I mean, which is what she was doing. She was an iconoclastic thinker. She was a very independent thinker, which, you know, you don't run across that many of those kinds of people.
You're listening to The County Writes, The County Reads. My guest is Marilyn Simons, author of Woman Watching, Louise de Kirlin Lawrence and the Songbirds of Pimissi Bay. Now, on your website, marilynsimons.com, you've recorded excerpts from your book, and I was interested in the one about her observation of the Canada Jay, because you write about the hours she spent observing a couple and their eggs, and unfortunately, it had a sad ending. But her report on the birds was the first time she'd been published, and she went on to break records in this field. What were some of her unique accomplishments? And let's start with the red-eyed vireo songs. Is that correct? Vireo? Is that how you say
it? Yes, that's right. Red-eyed vireo.
That was amazing.
I know. It's absolutely astonishing. I wonder if I can remember the year. I don't think I can. Yes, I can. 1949 or 45. Anyway, it was in the late 40s. She was already becoming known as an ornithologist, and she had a lot of connections in Europe as well as across North America. And so Noble Robbins, this British ornithologist, who was known as a dawn to dusk song expert. So that's a thing, right? To do a dawn to dusk song count. And he held the record for a dawn to dusk sound, song count for a European blackbird. And it was something around 6,000 calls. And so he contacted her and said, you know, would you like to do a project? Anything you want. And so she thought of the red-eyed vireo. She would count their songs. And for people who know the red-eyed vireo, it's an amazing song. I love it. It's a real song of spring for me. And yeah, she got up as usual. She always did a dawn walk. So she got up around 3:30 or so and was up before the sun, before the sky lightened. And she started counting, and the bird sang for 14 hours and sang 22,197 songs. And she counted every one of them. And that record still stands today. Yeah. It has never been broken, which is not surprising. And as I say in the book, it's an astonishing thing for a bird to sing that many songs, you know, from dawn to dusk. But I think it's even more astonishing for someone to go out and follow that bird, because that bird is, you know, flits along up in the canopy. It's not a ground-hugging bird. And to count every one of their songs.
Yeah, that's amazing. She was also an environmentalist, which I believe all bird watchers, professional or amateur, are. You write about the depletion of songbirds arriving in the 1950s and what Louise observed to be the reason for that. What was affecting the population of the birds that she discovered?
Well, she started watching birds in the late 30s when she first, you know, she left the quince because of the media craziness around them. And because she believed that the quince should be returned to their parents. And of course, by then they had become wards of the province, and it was just a nightmarish situation. So she decided she needed to leave, and she had this log cabin built on Pemisi Bay in this 5-acre piece of property. But it was wilderness. It was on the Mattawa River. And she started watching birds, not knowing the name of any of our birds. And she became very enamored of warblers, especially because they arrived now, you know, in the middle of May. They raise their families, and then they're starting to leave by the beginning of August. So they're we call them our birds, but they're actually here for a really short period of time. And so she started to track them, their nests, and their numbers in her forest. And she tracked 13 species of warblers in particular from 1943 until 1957. And all of the birds, their populations dropped by 10%. Two of the birds, the mourning warbler and the chestnut-sided warbler, dropped by 75%. So she knew that, you know, from year to year, populations vary. But this was over, more than a decade. And it was a steady decline. So she thought something was going on. And the thing that she thought was most likely was the toxic spraying of roadsides. So at that time, it would have been DDT. So she did a study. She took hydro cuts. And she mapped the number of songbirds on hydro cuts that were being sprayed and hydro cuts that were not being sprayed. And she mapped them before spraying and after spraying, and they were usually sprayed twice in a season. And the conclusions were pretty clear for her mind. A very small study, you know, experimentally. I'm sure there are scientists listening to this who say, well, that doesn't stand up.
Right.
And it doesn't. It was observational. But she felt that the roadside spraying, which she could observe with her own eyes, how all the plants withered and died, and there was no longer the sound of insects along there, and there were no longer birds along there. She linked those two things and published in the magazine that's now Ontario Nature. But I think what's interesting is that her data, which is phenomenal, detailed, and reams and reams and reams of it over 50 years, she sent all of her data to the National Museum of Natural History in Ottawa, to the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto, and to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And when Rachel Carson came along and started doing her research into linking decline of songbirds with toxic chemicals, it was the U.S. Fish and Wildlife data that she used. So in all likelihood, she was using Louise's data along with the data of hundreds and hundreds of amateur birders who self-trained ornithologists who sent their data in. And when Silent Spring came out, Louise was just thrilled that someone had taken the time to do a broad study to show that this was really at the heart of it, one of the reasons for the songbird decline. And I think she would be so distressed now to know that, you know, in the 50 years after her, we've lost another 3 billion birds.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost unconscionable. Well, it is completely unconscionable.
Yeah. Now, you started bird watching at that time in the 50s as a young girl.
Yes.
And you write about your bird watching as well. And what I wondered was, do you have a favorite bird? And did Louise?
That's an interesting question. Louise really loved the red-eyed vireo. She loved her chickadees. So she had a huge flock of chickadees on her property, and she fed them sunflower seeds, and they would sort of hover at her windows. They would recognize her. And when she was in a room, they would hover in that window, and they would move window to window when she moved, waiting for her to come outside. And she would stick sunflower seeds on her glasses and between her lips, and they would come and they'd take them right out from between her lips. So she certainly loved them. But, you know, I think I feel the same way as she did, that every bird is such a delight. You know, the hummingbirds are just coming back, and it's like, oh, cheer. Yay.
Yes.
Here they come, you know. And then the song sparrow this morning outside my window was just singing his little heart out, looking for a mate. And the house finches were looking for a nesting site, not very appropriately outside our front door. You know, and I mean, I live right in the middle of the city, right downtown. And there's still a tremendous amount of bird life around. And every bird I see is just a cause for celebration. Even the horribly squawking Caspian terns that fly overhead.
Well, Woman Watching is a remarkable book about an extraordinary woman. But now we have to talk about a lovely event happening on Monday, May 23rd.
Yes.
A wonderful way to wrap up the long weekend with a wine and cheese book launch at Bliznack's Gallery. What can people expect at that event?
Well, I'm going to be talking about the book a bit, and I'll be reading from the book. I haven't decided exactly what to read. Prince Edward County has some fantastic birders.
Oh, yes, I know.
Some amazing birders. And my husband Wayne and I have gone birding in Prince Edward County with Paul Jones, who's one of the best. And I've been out to the Bird Observatory when they were doing their Sawat Owl counts. So I'm not exactly sure what I will be reading, but I will be reading something from the book and talking to people. It's the end of the birding weekend. So if that birding festival is like every other birding festival that I've been to, the end of the weekend is always the moment for rehash. You know, uh-huh. What birds did you see, when and where? And I will be very interested in that, because we just came back from Pelee Island, where we spend a week every spring. And the birding was, you know, it was cold and wet and windy, and the birds just weren't leaving Ohio. That's all I can say. And so the birding wasn't very good. So I'm hoping that we'll be able to go early and do a bit of birding before we get to that event. I'm so looking forward to it. And the thing is, the ticket price includes a copy of the book. So I'll be signing books too, I would imagine.
Well, exactly. And it's $50, and that's the reading and meeting you and asking you questions and wine, snacks, and a copy of the book. Well worth it, I would say. It's just a terrific book. Well, thanks, Marilyn. It's always great to talk to you.
Well, and it's been great to talk to you again, Lynn. I obviously have to keep writing a book every 3 years in order to be able to meet like this.
I think you should start a book a year.
I don't think I'm that kind of a writer, alas. I wish I were.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Marilyn Simons, author of Woman Watching, Louise de Kirilin Lawrence, and the Songbirds of Pimisi Bay. is published by ECW Press. To hear excerpts from the book and see the woman watching video, go to Marilyn Simon's website, marilynsimons.com, and that's spelled M-E-R-I-L-Y-N, and Simons is S-I-M-O-N-D-S. The woman watching video was a family affair, produced and directed by Marilyn's granddaughter, Astrid Moore, with sound editing and engineering by her son, Carl Moore, and of course, written and narrated by Marilyn. As you heard, on Monday, May 23rd, Marilyn's going to be launching her book at Bliznax Gallery. The $50 ticket covers wine and cheese, a reading and Q&A with Marilyn, and a copy of the book. To order tickets, go to the Prince Edward Point Bird Observatory website, peptbo.ca.